What we're talking about now is a digital token that is backed by gold that will fit onto everyone's digital wallet so that you can get to the point where you have confidence and accessibility to gold on a digitalized basis, and you have confidence that that token is backed by hard gold. Through the beauty of blockchain and integrity systems, software systems that we have, you can actually chase that provenance back to know exactly where that gold is that's backing your digital token. And you can actually understand where that gold was mined from and moving it forward.
Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. We last spoke about gold on the Money Maze podcast in an interview 3 years ago with Evie Hambro, who runs the BlackRock Natural Resources team. And we discussed then that paper currencies have a 100% track record of losing purchasing power, whereas gold has a 100% record of permanence. And no student of financial history will be surprised that central banks since then have continued to print even more of their own currencies, following the well-worn path of debasement. And for those James Bond fans, in On Her Majesty's Secret Service, released in 1969, Count Draco offers James Bond £1 million in gold to marry his daughter. So I had a look at the data, and to have the equivalent purchasing power today of £10 in 1969, you'd need to have £163. And if you had bought gold in sterling at that time, it would be up 2,000%. So currency debasement is everywhere and continuous. And who better to shine the torch on this ever controversial asset than the chair of the World Gold Council and CEO of Wheaton Precious Metals? So Randy Smallwood from British Columbia today, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
I'm really looking forward to this. Thanks for having me.
Great. Well, for full disclosure, I've been a shareholder in Wheaton Precious Metals for many years and in the BlackRock World Mining Fund, which we'll talk about, and remain firmly in the camp that I view gold as a currency and distrust central banks and allocate to the space deliberately. And the aim today is threefold. Number one, to discuss gold at a high level, examining supply and demand, what history shows us, what central banks are up to, and why our guest observed recently that gold is in a perfect position now. Number two is to examine its role in portfolios and how to invest and access it. And number three is to examine the merits and demerits in owning gold equities and understand the business of Wheaton, a highly regarded gold streaming company, which is a different type of equity to gain gold exposure. But Randy, let's start with you and your history. You studied at the University of British Columbia. You have a degree in geological engineering. Was this something that grabbed you from a very early age?
Well, it's actually interesting. When I came out of high school, of course, it was last century, as you can tell by my silver hair. Computers were sort of the newest rage. And so I started off in computer science, but quickly realized that I was never interested in having a binary world, ones and zeros. That's not the way the world works. And so I quickly lost interest in that and drifted around for quite a while. So I was, I was probably 23 years old, 24 years old when I got my first job staking mineral claims in northern Canada, just working as a bush rat, really. And so I was a mature student. I actually didn't even start at UBC until I was 26 years old and graduated on my 30th birthday in geological engineering. But the difference is I knew that this is what I wanted. I covered this through working out in the field, and I was incredibly passionate about it and still am today. The whole complexity inside of geology and the challenges of finding a good ore body and trying to make sure that you build it in a way that delivers maximum value to all the stakeholders around it. I still get excited about it today in terms of the thrill of exploration, this thrill of discovery. And I was fortunate because very early in my career, I actually was part of a discovery of a very relatively small but high-grade gold ore body, and I had the great fortune of taking it from exploration discovery through to definition, resource, defining reserves, doing the feasibility studies, and then they said, okay, go build it if this is what you say it is. And so I became the project manager and ultimately became the mine manager at a very small but very high-grade gold operation, again, back in the 1990s. we were producing gold for about $100 an ounce, which was very, even in those low gold prices, was still a very profitable operation. And being able to take an asset from discovery all the way through to production is something that not a lot of people get in this industry. Usually you wind up either being an exploration specialist or a development and construction specialist or an operations specialist, but you don't see that full breadth. And what it has done, and this is very important, it's given me a very sincere, very strong appreciation for the challenges of how hard it is to find a good ore body, an immense respect for the effort that goes into that.
And somewhat akin to that, we had Bruce Cleaver, co-chair of De Beers, on a few weeks ago, and he was similarly talking about that whole process, which, of course, in a world where manufacturing and mining has been pushed aside from, shall we say, the limelight of what's sexy, it's very interesting to reconnect with what is such a critical area of business. We're going to talk about that. But how then did your career progress to Wheaton?
As I said, we uncovered a small-scale but very profitable ore body. It's called the Golden Bear Mine in northern BC, and we ran that mine for about 5 or 6 years in a time when gold prices were $300 an ounce, $350 an ounce, but we were building up a capital base. And what I would say is that ultimately, the original Wheaton River, which ultimately morphed into Goldcorp and has now been swallowed up by Newmont, amongst other companies being swallowed up by Newmont, but we used that grubstake, that initial capital that we'd built up, to bring in Ian Telfer and to start building the original Wheaton River into Goldcorp. And part of that whole process was the creation of the streaming model back in 2004. And that's where the original Silver Wheaton and now Wheaton Precious Metals was created. And really at that point, 2004, we were looking at streaming as a way to raise capital to continue growing Goldcorp. And so we didn't really respect what we'd actually created when we came up with the first streaming model, because we were on the receiving end just looking to raise capital. Took us a few years to sort of wake up to the concept of, geez, this streaming model, it's not a bad business. And I kind of swung over to it full time in 2007, and it's been away to the races.
Okay, so we're going to come back to streaming a little later on, but let's just start with gold at a high level. And I'm particularly interested in the supply demand. One of the observations that I believe I'm right in saying is that gold supply increases by less than or not much more than 2% per annum. So are we right in saying that broadly supply is highly constrained?
Oh, very much so. And getting more constrained all the time. It is getting tougher and tougher to, first off, discover, but then second off, permit and get mines built. And so it just reinforces the value that we have in our existing operations to make sure that they're run effectively. But it is getting tougher and tougher to build new mines.
And am I right in saying these expressions get bandied around, but all the gold ever mined fills two Olympic swimming pools?
Well, it wouldn't even quite fill, but yeah, pretty close. Amazing in terms of the amount of effort that goes into it. And the beauty of gold is that it's circular. None of it ever gets wasted. Obviously, with such a focus on ESG and on sustainability, one of the beautiful aspects of gold is that it is truly, in the phrase in ESG circles, is circular in the sense that none of it ever gets wasted. It gets recycled and reused. It's, you know, society values it so strongly that we'd never let it go to waste. And so it's a commodity that continues to be used and doesn't have a consumption aspect to it in terms of it disappearing. Once it's brought into the financial world, it stays in that financial world.
Yes, and I've had the discussion, or should I say sometimes even argument, with those who believe, as did John Maynard Keynes, that gold is a barbarous relic, where they said, but it doesn't have an economic application like oil. I said, that's the very point, is that oil is consumed and has to be replaced. And also, when you have more difficult times, you want to have something that is less economically sensitive.
Well, and it's interesting, because the other aspect that I'd say with gold is the liquidity. It is accepted everywhere. There's not a single human being on this planet that doesn't understand the worth of gold and what it actually delivers in terms of that. And it always amazes me that we have people that have been around forever. I've been to a small little placer mining operation where they pull out little gold nuggets, and the operator up there, he's been doing it for 50, 60 years. And every time he sees a nugget, he breaks into a big smile. It just warms people up.
Clearly, we got a supply constrained one side of the equation. And on the other, on the demand side, we've obviously had quite a lot of high-profile buying, certainly of late, by the central banks. Give us a sense of the demand side of the equation.
Last year was actually very interesting, because one of the reasons that I think the US dollar has been relatively successful as a fiat reserve currency is the fact that most people believed that U.S. dollar, the almighty U.S. buck, was pretty apolitical. It wasn't a political instrument. It had very little political influence. That changed last year. Last year, when the United States restricted Russia's access to the SWIFT system, and for all the right reasons, in terms of what's going on with Russia and the Ukraine, it's horrendous. And we should be doing everything we can to try and stop that from happening. But the key point there was that the U.S. dollar was all of a sudden weaponized. It became a political device. What that has caused every single central banker in the world, their responsibility for these sovereign nations is to build up a reserve base that withstands all sorts of challenges and is supposed to be immune to sort of political influence. And what they've realized is the U.S. dollars that they have in their central bank reserves, they're not as apolitical as what they once thought they were. And that's why we're just seeing such a strong shift towards, well, let's look around. Let's find what is the only apolitical currency in the world? Gold.
Before we take this episode any further, a quick note from our sponsors. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is a British company based in Henley that was established 20 years ago by two young brothers whose dream was to design and engineer beautiful chronometers. When Giles English, one of those brothers, appeared as a guest on the Money Maze podcast last year, he brought to life the wonderful history of British watchmaking, helping to explain why the world sets its time by Greenwich Mean Time, and he captured the incredible challenge of mastering the complexities involved in making exquisitely engineered timepieces. He has said, "Never judge one of our watches until you've held it in your hand and felt the quality." And both Will Campion and I have bought a watch, and we love them. Great innovation, a tangible love for their mission, resulting in beautiful, world-class luxury wristwatches. In addition, I'd like to quickly share a few details about Gain, who we're highlighting and supporting as our 2023 third quarter partner. Gain, which stands for Girls Are Investors, is a leading charity dedicated to improving gender diversity in the investment management industry. Gain currently has a team of over 1,000 volunteers dedicated to helping young women understand the industry and their potential careers in it. They're always open to welcoming new volunteers or sponsors who are looking to support their mission. If this is something yourself or any of your colleagues might be interested in, please visit gainuk.org to learn more, or just tap the link in the episode description right here in your preferred podcast app. And we saw in the FT, I think today, it was again more evidence of Chinese buying of gold. But it struck me that there is an inescapable irony here, and that's the world's central banks are acquiring something with limited supply, while simultaneously they are issuing more and more of their own currencies without great restraint.
Maybe they know something.
So just tell us a little bit about what it is that the World Gold Council seeks to achieve and how it's arranged.
So the World Gold Council is a group that's been around, I think, just over 50 years now. And really, it was created from the mining industry, and it represents the members of the World Gold Council are the biggest gold miners in the world and the biggest streaming and royalty companies in the world. And so we've got about, 40-some-odd members, but we do represent about 70% of worldwide gold production. It's very influential and very representative in terms of gold production around the world. And it's really an advocacy group for gold, and its primary focus is to supply information to the general public. I can tell you one of the more popular programs we run right now is central bank education seminars on the value of gold. Those courses are overflowing. We've been running those for a long time, and we're getting a lot of uptake from the bankers that work, the people that work for the central banks around the world. But what we really do is sort of, it's an advocacy group for gold as a broader industry, and it represents the mining side. Now, we do have a pretty exciting initiative that we've kicked off in the last couple of years called Gold 247. And the 247 stands for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And what we're undertaking right now is an effort to bring gold ownership into the 21st century, so to speak. When we sit and look around with the capacity of shared ledgers or blockchain, whatever you want to call it, and the capacity of provenance tracking and fingerprinting and such, we think that we can bring gold ownership into the 21st century by digitalizing ownership of gold. And in a sense, it already is capable. You can go out and buy shares in an ETF that's backed by gold and essentially move that gold ownership, digitalize that ownership of that gold. But it's not really fungible. It's tough to move those shares around. You have to buy them back in. You have to put them back in. It runs through a brokerage account, etc. What we're talking about now is a digital token that is backed by gold that will fit onto everyone's digital wallet so that you can get to the point where you have confidence and accessibility to gold on a digitalized basis, and you have confidence that that token is backed by hard gold through the beauty of blockchain and integrity systems, software systems that we have. You can actually chase that provenance back to know exactly where that gold is that's backing your digital token, and you can actually understand where that gold was mined from and moving it forward. And so we're well on our way towards presenting a digitalized version of owning gold that is very readily accessible and will be available onto multiple digital wallets, bank accounts, etc. In reality, what we're creating here is currency that is, you know, essentially the gold standard. And we're going to make it incredibly easy. With today's technology, it's quite easy to put this in place. Our effort right now is to work with the institutional side, to work with a lot of the bullion banks and central banks for that matter, but the vaulters, to try and get uptake there to help them sort of move their way towards this digitalized equivalent of trading and owning gold and moving gold around as a measure of value, as a store of value, but being able to sell quickly with instant settlement, not none of this 4 or 5 day settlement that you currently have in some of the different precious metals bullion exchanges. But to have instant settlement and be able to move it around. And once you get to that stage, I think we've created a currency. And so we're not far off of that. This is going to be coming out within the next year, year and a half.
So I was talking to a number of people ahead of this interview, and one of them was Matt Smith, who's the director at Ruffa, the UK investment firm, and he wanted to talk about the tokenization of gold. And the thing that left me scratching my head is that I own gold, and I own it in various formats, and I feel it settles quickly, whether you do it through futures or whether you do it through an ETF or whether you do it through physical bullion. When you put it in this digitalized form, how do we think about your counterpart, and how do we think about it versus the other fact, which is I can go and take a gold coin or a gold bar and I can move it from bank A, or I can put it in my wardrobe if I want.
We're not going to replace the way you can own gold. We're only expanding the way that you can own gold. In fact, in the ideal world, our long-term objective is the fact that you should be able to have a digital wallet on your smartphone or on your smartwatch or whatever. And there should be a button that you push and have physical gold delivered to just reinforce the fact that each of these tokens is backed up by physical gold. And so the key thing is we're not changing the way you can own gold. We're only expanding it and making it easier. And in fact, my argument would be is that the objective is to make it so easy that it becomes a currency. It becomes as free as a currency. And I know when I get to go traveling around the world and I stick my credit card into a machine to pay for a dinner or pay for a flight or a hotel, it asks me, do I want to pay in Canadian dollars? Do I want to pay in British pounds? Do I want to pay in euros? Do I want to pay in US dollars? There's no reason why that interface shouldn't also be able to ask, do you want to pay in gold, gold tokens? And I think the approach, we need to have a standard gold unit, a measure that we can count essentially the dollar of the gold space. And I would argue that value-wise, it's probably a gram of gold, and that'll be the unit that we measure our gold in, and that's what we'll trade around in. It can be fractionalized, you can have full provenance behind it. Basically, you come up with digital certificates that are backed by real gold stored, and through the benefits of blockchain, you can actually look at the address as to where this is stored. And so it really is about making it so easy, but the fact that it's got hard assets behind it, apolitical assets behind that token, just makes it incredibly attractive to society. And we're seeing all sorts of challenges in the crypto space. But the whole drive behind the crypto space was to push down this path, to get away from the political influence and try and come up with an equivalent currency. Well, it turns out society's had that all the way along. It's called gold, but we just have to improve the way gold is traded. And then we've got our apolitical currency that can be moved around.
Right. And there's only one as opposed to the, whatever it is, 6,000 plus of these so-called digital currencies. Anyway, let's not go there. You said, Randy, recently that gold is in a perfect position now. Could you just elaborate on that, please?
It doesn't take much to look around the world and see the challenges that governments face. And it is. Most governments do not run a balanced budget perspective. They just continue printing and pushing out. And so when it comes to a store of value, you talk about inflation. I prefer trying to simplify things. You talk about inflation. Inflation just means that the dollar you have in your pocket isn't worth a dollar a year from now. Whereas gold holds that value. And so when it comes to a store of value, a measure of value, I don't think there's been a better framework, a better time for people to understand what gold truly does deliver to society. And I think it's set up quite well for that.
Yeah, it was Ray Dalio of Bridgewater who said that, gold success is the inverse of confidence in the central banks and governments.
I've been accused many times of only having a good time when everyone else is having a bad time.
So let's move to the second part, which is that if one believes in the case for allocation and a role in portfolios, how do you summarize those benefits in a portfolio? Because I do see on your website that World Gold Council has produced a paper, The Four Fundamental Roles of Gold in a Portfolio. But how would you summarize it to, and we have lots of allocators on this show around the gold world, how would you summarize the case for having it in a portfolio? What does it do?
I always go back to there's two aspects that gold has delivered forever, for as long as mankind has been on this planet. It's the store of value and the measure of value. It's a constant store of value. It's a constant measure of value. It can't be copied. It can't be mass produced. And so I think that when it comes to that, with respect to portfolios, it should be a foundation component. It's the foundation that you build off of. And within the gold space, of course, you can invest into the miners. And really there, you're investing more into the profitability of a service that's being applied and end product being measured in gold. But you're also putting yourself at the risk and potential upside of how that mining company performs. At the other end of the spectrum is just owning raw bullion. And the challenge with raw bullion is that it doesn't grow. It doesn't have the growth aspect. You definitely get price exposure and such. So there's many ways to invest into gold. Quite a wide spectrum, all the way from exploration development companies all the way back, which is the high end of the risk side, but also the high end of the potential reward side, all the way down to the other end where you're dealing with bullion. So it comes down to the portfolio itself and what you're trying to get back from that part. But gold should always be a foundation component of any portfolio. It's the foundation that you build everything else up off of.
Well, I agree, and I sit on several investment committees, and it's amazing to me how much resistance I meet when this brought up. And I thought in that paper, which we will put in our show notes and the email that goes out, is those two other elements, which is one, of course, is a diversifier that can mitigate losses in times of market stress. And of course, it's a liquid asset with no credit risk. And the old is the only asset that doesn't represent somebody else's liability. So we've got bullion, we've got gold miners, we've got gold streamers. So let's talk a little bit about the gold versus the alternatives, and specifically gold equities, because there's obviously a lot of discussion when people decide to allocate to gold about how they're going to do it. And when I was at Vantage, the hedge fund that I was with for a number of years, we sort of worked out that we wanted our gold exposure 70% bullion and 30% gold equities. And we know that gold equities are inherently more precarious for all sorts of reasons we'll come back to. But actually, I took a look at some work that had been done of the gold mining companies versus the Barron's Gold Index. And the reason for using that is it goes back a very long time, over 50 years. And it's pretty interesting that on a long-term secular basis, the gold stocks underperformance versus gold is becoming more and more pronounced. Rallies, but more and more pronounced. And I wondered how you thought about that.
I think people have to realize that when it comes to the mining industry, as I said, it's almost a bit of a service industry. If you sit and think about gold ore bodies, and I am going to generalize because each ore body is unique. But one of the things that you suffer from in the gold mining industry is the fact that when prices are stronger, high-grade waste becomes low-grade ore. Now, waste means you can't make money mining it and processing it, but ore means you can. Low-grade ore, though, means that it's relatively high cost on a per-ounce basis in terms of going forward. And so one of the things that the mining companies suffer from is, and again, I'm generalizing, but as commodity prices go up, the size of an ore body will grow because lower grade, higher strip ratio materials along the flanks of an ore body will all of a sudden become part of that ore body, but the costs are higher with respect to that material. So it's a challenge that what I've seen in my time in this industry is that mining companies tend to have a relatively consistent operating margin above whatever that price is. And they tend to, as the price climbs, so does their cost per ounce. And so they wind up, and again, in a general sense, delivering the same values back to their shareholders, irrespective of what the price is, because they wind up chasing this lower grade material that becomes economic with higher prices. And they relatively have consistent margins. And I am generalizing because there are certain ore bodies where there is no low grade material. And so no doubt nothing changes at the mine when the price goes up, other than the fact they're getting a lot more money. So there are unique situations like that. Those are the type of companies you actually look for, because those are the ones that deliver the best value back. That's the aspect of the mining industry that's quite challenging, is making sure that you pick the right assets, the right companies, the right projects that will deliver those stronger margins in a higher price environment versus chasing lower grade material and delivering essentially relatively constant margins. And so it is a unique aspect of the mining industry that is something that you always should keep in mind.
Yeah, I think I can say it probably more easily, and that's that capital discipline has often been lacking in the mining industry. And that's why their returns don't stack up. And I think that in turn leads to this sense of caution amongst investors. Now, if we turn that on its head, I was talking to Evie Hambrough, who runs the BlackRock World Gold Fund and has been a guest on the show. And I asked him how big the UK fund was, that World Mining Trust, and it's £1 billion, the UK share class, and it peaked at £3 billion. And I think if you look at the total market cap of listed mining companies around the world, I think that your assistant told me it might be around $200 billion. I haven't got the number exactly to hand.
The GDX right now is about $300 billion.
Well, I hope you're enjoying this episode so far. We've got lots more to come, but a quick pause. We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment manager whose purpose is to provide excellent investment performance through active decision-making. For more than two centuries, Schroders has evolved their understanding of markets, offering investment solutions across fixed income, equities, multi-asset, as well as private markets through Schroders Capital. Schroders actively invests in companies with responsible and durable business models. They're also a leading specialist in impact investing for clients who want to maximize positive change. Capital is at risk with investing. Last year, I interviewed Gary Boom, chief executive of Bordeaux Index. Wine is a great love of mine, and as he explained, Bordeaux Index has become a major disruptor in the way that wine is bought and sold, and has sought to redefine the way a wine merchant works. I've been really impressed with their business, and have been buying wine from them since that interview. So we're delighted that the Money Maze podcast is now also sponsored by LiveTrade, their world-leading fine wine trading platform. LiveTrade has changed the way fine wine is bought and sold worldwide. You can instantly buy and sell or place bids and offers on key wines from Bordeaux, Champagne, Italy, and other world regions. Their two-way pricing offers guaranteed trading liquidity with no fees. So I recommend you have a look at their website, BordeauxIndex.com/LiveTrade. Okay, so in the scheme of a world with trillions of dollars sloshing around it, it's a small market cap relative to lots of other things. And you've got central bankers who are interested in bullion for obvious reasons. What are you observing from the investor community about gold stocks?
Well, I do think that one of the things that the investing community is suffering from right now is a real push towards index investing. And index investing means you're just chasing averages. That is a challenge. And so, firms like BlackRock, you mentioned Evie Hambrough, he's been very, very good at picking off individual assets, and he and his team, individual assets that actually have delivered great returns on a go-forward basis. But in a broader base, we're seeing less and less of that, more and more index investing, which means you're just chasing the average. And yeah, there's no doubt there's less risk, but as we all know, risk and reward correlate very, very strongly. And chasing less risk also means there's less potential reward. And I think that's one of the things that's really impacting the gold space right now. But it is interesting. Like you sit and you talk about the GDX at $300 billion. The S&P 500 right now, if you look at that, the total market cap's about $35 trillion. Currently, GDX is less than 1% of the combined market caps of the entire S&P 500, whereas back in headier days, 2011, 2012, when we last saw gold at these kind of prices, the GDX represented about 3% of the S&P 500. And so we've definitely got a lot more space for the gold industry to grow. And I say, when you sit and look at the mining industry right now, it's actually quite profitable right now. And if you look at the cash flows and the money that's coming out of the mining industry, we are not being traded where we deserve to be on a relative basis. And that will change as we continue to deliver, hopefully, better and better returns. The investing public will take notice. And so we should see that coming, hopefully, relatively soon.
Yeah, no, I had noticed that margins have been improving, earnings forecasts have been rising, and one of the big inputs, of course, oil has been pulling back as well, which is helpful. That allows us, I think, having discussed bullion and then gold stocks, to come to the world of streaming. And there will be a lot of investors who are not familiar with streaming. And I think they're right in saying there are only three companies, Franco-Nevada, Goldcorp, and yourselves, who do that. And you're a big company. You're a $20 billion market cap. You were spun out of Goldcorp. I think I'm right in saying you delivered over $1 billion in revenue last year and $740 million in operating cash flow. But could we just start at the highest level? Please, could you just explain the basics of the streaming model?
Well, so it's interesting because as I mentioned earlier on here, we created this because we needed some capital at Goldcorp. So we created the streaming model and built the original streaming company, which was Silver Wheat, now Wheaton Precious Metals. And the reason we did that was because we had a bunch of non-core silver byproduct production in our gold mines at Goldcorp. And what we saw at that time, this is back in 2004, 2005, was that there wasn't a lot of profitable silver opportunities out there, but there was a lot of silver investors looking for profitable production. And back then, silver prices were down around $5, $6 an ounce. And if you looked at most of the silver mining companies, they were losing money on a consistent basis. And so the concept of forming a profitable silver company at the time, but taking the cost risk out. Typically, here's what happens in the mining industry is if you're investing into mining companies, most of the failures relate to cost surprises, so to speak. Either operating costs are higher than expected or capital costs are higher than expected, and the asset is just not as profitable as it was originally forecast. With a streaming company, we take that risk out. Our capital costs are defined in the original contract up front. And so what we do is we approach a large number of mines around the world. We've got over 30 mines around the world right now in Wheaton. And we buy their non-core precious metals byproduct from these mines. And so we'll go in and make an upfront payment. A more recent example was Lumina Copper, which we've just announced a deal in the last 3 weeks where we're going to pay them $300 million dollars up front. And then as that mine begins production, they'll be delivering us, I think it's 8% of the gold production. And when that gold gets delivered to us, we'll make a production payment of about 20% of the spot price. So our profit comes from, because we get 8%, as that mine grows, as it expands, as it explores and has success, we get access to good, solid precious metals production from these mines without having exposure to the cost risk. Our production payment is fixed. It's 20% of the spot price. We don't have exposure to the capital cost risk. We make that fixed payment, at $300 million payment up front, and we deliver good, profitable precious metals production to our shareholders. And of course, as in any mining company, the company is only as good as the assets that it invests into. And I think where we've had success at Wheaton is being very, very selective. We're very, very technically driven. I'm a geological engineer, as you know, and spent most of my life in project evaluations and determining what to buy or what to invest into, and perhaps more importantly, what not to invest into. And so we get access to some pretty incredible ore bodies, pretty incredible operations, very profitable operations, and we get a portion of the precious metals production from them, whether it be gold from copper mines, or silver from lead zinc mines, or gold from nickel mines. These are all very profitable operations, and we get a portion of that production coming to us. So this year, our company will produce about 630,000 gold equivalent ounces at a cash cost of somewhere around $400, $450 per ounce. And there's no surprises in there. Those are good fixed numbers. And so it's a very, very strong model that we've had great success in terms of what we've been able to build.
which is why I think I was intrigued when I looked at the BlackRock Gold Fund and saw it was the third biggest position. And then that triggered another conversation. But your clients, I believe, are large mining companies like Glencore and Vale and others. Now, is it for them defraying some of that early capital risk?
Exactly. That's the beauty of a stream. And the way I love to describe it is it'll take a good mine and make it a great mine because it drives. And the best example that I can give you is our flagship asset, which is the Salobo mine down in Brazil. So it's owned by Vale. Everyone knows Vale for their iron ore production. They actually have some pretty decent base metal production as a byproduct. They have a number of large-scale copper mines and nickel mines around the world. And all of those mines produce a little bit of gold and a little bit of silver. Well, the Salobo mine down in Brazil was built back in 2010, 2011, started up production. Altogether, that mine cost around $4 billion to build. We actually supplied Vale $3.1 billion in upfront payments. So we paid pretty close to 80% of the capital cost of this mine. But for that, we get 75% of whatever gold comes from this mine. That will average around 250,000 gold ounces per year to our credit. And so when you look at this, from the Vale shareholders' perspective, their capital invested into that mine was about $900 million. Their return on that invested capital is, in fact, they generate over $1 billion in EBITDA off that mine every year. So the return on their invested capital is dramatically stronger because they only have to invest $900 million. We supplied the other $3.1 billion. We get access to very profitable gold production at a cash cost of around $400 per ounce. And as I said, the asset just continues to grow. It's about a 40 to 50 year mine life right now, and it's going through an expansion. So we're going to see on order of 250 to 300,000 ounces a year from this mine going forward. So it's a win-win situation where we supply the capital up front during the construction process to limit their risk, but it also dramatically improves their return on invested capital, the operator's invested capital. And we get access to some top quality, high margin gold production. It's a very strong model, win-win, the best type of transaction when both sides are actually successful.
And more broadly, there's been a lot of concern around environmental damage, around mines, and we know that these are huge undertakings. And how is the industry thinking about broad ESG considerations, and particularly in the communities in which they operate? Because I sense this is become very front and center stage for the mining companies.
There's no doubt. And in fact, I'm proud of Wheaton's track record as a streaming company because we don't actually operate mines. We literally have 40 employees in our company. And so we don't actually operate the mines. But for the last 10 years, we kickstarted 10 years ago, co-funding programs where we help our partners, our operating partners, by expanding their capacity to deliver sustainable benefits to their communities, their neighboring communities on a go-forward basis. And so I've said this before, the one thing about the gold mining industry is I don't think there's a better example of wealth redistribution than the gold mining industry, because most of these mines are in very remote rural locations scattered around the world, remote parts of Africa. And these are areas that are, it's very tough for anyone to have any type of a decent standard of living. A lot of the subsistence farming and such in areas like this. What you have is you have the standards that come with a responsible, well-run gold mining operation. The benefits that come into these communities is substantial in terms of improving of infrastructure. They just deliver good, strong benefits all the way through, whether it's healthcare, education systems, power supplies, all sorts of benefits to these remote rural communities. And so we have to focus on making sure that we do our best to deliver sustainable, positive benefits to all the stakeholders on a go-forward basis. And the industry continues to focus on that. At the World Gold Council, we have a responsible gold mining principles, the RGMPs, which all of our members have committed to. And it really does. It goes back to the United Nations sustainability initiatives. And it's really focused on ensuring that we do the best we can to deliver good, strong, sustainable benefits to the communities that are around us, our neighbors. And so it's a continuing focus. And in fact, an area that we continue to push forward, even on the environmental performance in terms of a push towards trying to decarbonize the efforts that we've put in at different mines in terms of solar power, run a river, hydropower, wind power, to try and minimize the amount of carbon-based fuel systems that are used to operate here is every year stronger and stronger in terms of pushing that down. And so as an industry, we have to continue to improve on this space. We have to make sure that the footprints that we leave on this earth are as little impact as possible in terms of doing that and as much benefit as possible to society.
Tacking to talent, we have lots of young people who listen to the show as well, and lots of people who go to finance and consulting. But tell us a little bit about, is the industry struggling to attract talent? Is it short of engineers and geologists? And what advice would you offer to young folks thinking about careers?
It is a challenge. Society seems to be pushing itself more towards urban environments, and we see constant shift towards ever increasing larger and larger cities and the comforts attached to that, and not as much focus in terms of building in rural locations and trying to move forward. So it's getting tougher and tougher, especially with some remote locations. But I tell you, and I urge all those youth to seriously consider, the mining industry does have a challenging reputation in terms of some of the scars that we leave on this planet, but be part of the change. Society needs these resources. Society needs these minerals. There's a phrase that's been used quite a bit here, critical minerals. As we electrify, as we decarbonize this planet, we will need these metals. And so I encourage them to consider, instead of standing on the outside looking in and critiquing as to the potential impacts, come on into the industry and explore it. As I talked about when we first started this call, the thrill of discovery, the thrill of creating value, the thrill of just improving and delivering good, strong, sustainable impacts and benefits to all the member communities around these assets, it's quite a rewarding career. And be part of the change that continues to improve what we deliver to society.
That's helpful, Randy. Thank you. Now, we're going to have some general questions. I want to first of all give a shout out to Nick Feingold of the Curation Collective, who introduced us, and he runs a business focusing on intelligent market insights and lots of very interesting ideas for investors. And we'll put the links on our show notes. But one of our questions we like to ask, because it was named after that book, if you could tell us just one thing, which is giving advice to other people, particularly young people, what would you want to offer as a piece of advice?
The one thing that I find a little bit frustrating in society is this NIMBY approach. We all love having access to technology, to electric cars, to electric phones, you know, or smartphones and such like this, but we don't want the mines in areas where you've got good, strong regulatory environments, environmental standards, and such. And I really do think that society should take a bit more of an approach of, look, if we're going to consume it, then we should find ways to produce it, as opposed to shifting it off to regions of the planet where there isn't the same level of standards, there isn't the same level of environmental standards and such. And so I do really think that communities, countries, sovereign nations should all look at what they consume and are you being responsible in terms of just saying, we don't want mines here, but please send us your copper, send us your nickel, send us your gold, your silver. I think we all need to take responsibility, the fact that we do have a measure of consumption, and we should try and find ways to be responsible about how that consumption is sourced and making sure that we are choosing the best thing, irrespective of whether it's in our backyard or not.
And tell me, along the way, have there been one or two particular mistakes or obstacles which have been particularly helpful for you as you have moved on from them?
I would say that when I was at Goldcorp and we created the original streaming company, Silver Wheaton, it took us about 3 years to realize what we'd created. It was interesting because I was still working at Goldcorp and we were focused on trying to build a gold company. The challenge was that we were so focused on that and we weren't doing anything on the streaming side with the original Silver Wheaton. But every once in a while, we get a phone call from some other company saying, hey, you know that streaming thing you did? We'd like to do some of that. We'd like some of that dessert. And it took us about 3 or 4 years to think, yeah, maybe we should put some dedicated focus towards the streaming model. And it's a bit of a shame because that 4 years, in terms of the pricing and stuff like that, we've had great success. But I know there was a large number of assets we could have easily picked up in those first 4 or 5 years. So I kind of regret not seizing the opportunity earlier than what we ultimately did. But we still continue to deliver into new projects, and we've got one of the strongest growth profiles we've ever had right now. So it's clear that we're still doing some good things here.
Now, I noticed on, it might have been your LinkedIn profile, but unmistakably looked like it was a picture of you high in the mountain. So is that where you go to find a source of relaxation?
Yeah, I'm an avid skier. It's definitely a passion of mine. And like I say, the mountains are my spirit, so to speak. And so I spend a lot of time in those mountains. I live here in Vancouver. I actually own a place over in London also. And so we do get over to London on a regular basis. But I can tell you, I don't travel much when it's ski season here, because if I get a chance, I'm going to be up on the ski hills.
Presumably, is that Whistler or is that somewhere?
That's Whistler.
So that's Whistler, yeah, which I haven't skied, but I'm told can have some of the best powder in the world. So we've been short of that in Europe for a while.
Yeah, no, it's big mountains out here in Western Canada. And so it is one of the advantages of Vancouver, is that it takes about an hour to disappear into the mountains there and you can really recharge yourself. So between the skiing and the boating, it's a pretty good place.
Right. Well, that's been a really enjoyable conversation. I like to sum up with some of the conclusions and observations, and I think that we tried to cover today the fact that for many, goal doesn't feature in their thinking around allocations, and allocators may want to check themselves and say, is that right? Somebody else that I interviewed recently said, it's not just what you have in your portfolio, it's why you have it. But I think that I would take that a step further. It's why you don't have it about, in this case, gold. Secondly, how you approach it can be obviously through a variety of mechanisms, with bullion being the central safest. Then there are the gold mining companies, and then there is your own company with a very interesting profile. But the World Gold Council, as you have said, is discussing opening up access to the gold market through tokenization, which will be very interesting to follow. And I can't finish this conversation without a little look back in history about our own country, because it was sort of gnawing away at me. And in 1999, the then Chancellor, Gordon Brown, sold off 400 tons of British gold, which was half of our reserves. And he did it at $275 an ounce. It's now trading at $2,000 an ounce. I would say that it was probably the worst investment decision possibly any chancellor has ever made. But before we close, I'm going to leave the final words to the great Stan Druckenmiller, global thinker, macro investor, who was referring to the recent debt ceiling discussions and saying how they should be put in context. And his quotation was, "It's like sitting on a pier worrying about the potential damage of an incoming 30-foot wave when there is a 200-foot tsunami just 10 miles out." So, worth considering in the context of gold. So I'm going to leave it at that. But what I will say, Randy, is it's been a great pleasure seeing you today. Look forward to meeting you in London, because I think you'll be there before I'm in Vancouver. And good luck with your plans at the World Gold Council and at Wheaton.
Simon, I really enjoyed it. Thank you. And I do look forward to seeing you face to face.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.